Great morning, everyone, and welcome to yet another episode of Thank God for Monday. I'm Brother Greg Cellini of the Franciscan Brothers of Brooklyn in the Office of Mission Ministry Interfaith Dialogue at St. Francis College in beautiful Brooklyn, New York. My great pleasure to be back with you again today. The purpose of our show, Thank God for Monday, is to inspire you, our audience, to take personal responsibility for your professional satisfaction. We want to provide you hope, healing, peace in these unprecedented, turbulent, uncertain times, motivate you to search deep inside yourself in the quest for fulfillment. Listeners, it's really up to you as I utilize the information we provide today, take full accountability for the decisions you make and a resulting outcome. And one of the goals of our show, Thank God for Monday, is to introduce role models of people who take very bold steps in their work lives. This is a very unique time in our workplace and our world when technology has never been more important. And as such, we are honored today to have with us a very, very special guest. His name is Paul V. McEnroe. Paul is an award-winning engineer who developed state-of-the-art products the world depends upon today. During his 23-year career with IBM, he developed innovations which became industry standards. Paul led the team that developed the Universal Product Code, also known as UPC, and commonly known as the barcode. He also created the first commercial application of laser technology, the barcode scanner, and the magnetic code for stock keeping unit marking. He is also the author of a wonderful memoir entitled The Barcode: How a Team Created One of the World's Most Ubiquitous Technologies. Great morning and welcome to Thank God for Monday, Paul.
Well, good morning to you, Greg. I appreciate your having me.
The honor is all ours. Kindly share with the listeners and me what city and state you're speaking from this morning, please.
Yes, I'm from a ranch in the San Ynez Valley of California, about an hour's drive north of Santa Barbara, California, not too far from the coast.
You've just made the listeners and this host very, very jealous. One of the most beautiful places in the world. Sadly, Paul, we've only got about 30 minutes. We've got a lot to talk about your incredible life, this book that you've written. We're going to jump right into the deep end of the pool. Share with us, please, what is this great memoir, Barcode, all about?
Well, I was encouraged by my family to write a memoir of my life and things that happened in it that was fairly interesting and so on. And I did that. I had been in the computer world various places for about 35, 40 years. And then I retired from that and became a rancher and was in the ranching community for the last 25, 30 years. And as I got this memoir going and they read some early drafts of it, they said, "Hey, the part about the barcode is of interest to everybody in the world, everywhere, you know, from China to India to, you know, Australia, blah, blah." And so you just really need to focus on that and get that story out. So I did that. I took most of the personal stuff out of the book, although it is still a memoir and there are still plenty of interesting stories in it. But I took most of my personal life and family life out and concentrated mostly on the barcode and the interesting stories about how the barcode came along. And so that's how I got into writing the book.
Wow, that's fascinating. And it's amazing because, as our Thank God for Monday listeners know, I'm a terrible reader, but this book is so captivating. The story is so unique. It really is amazing and just a beautiful, beautiful memoir you've put together. Now, it's always helpful for the listeners and me to have a bit of context. So, you were working with IBM. Did they encourage innovation during the 60s and 70s? And if so, how did they do this, please, Paul?
Yeah, you bet. The encouragement of innovation was really pretty much up to the engineering development organizations of which I was a part. After college, I was fortunate enough to get a job at IBM, and I was assigned a laboratory to work in California. I particularly wanted to go to California because my father had encouraged me to go to the West. I grew up in Ohio, and so I was exposed to a lot of different development ideas. And of course, all the people in the development organization are very interested and focused on innovation to a great degree. But what happened was that the president of and CEO of IBM, a guy named Frank Carey, decided that he wanted to buy new companies to get bigger growth for IBM because he was worried that the growth in the computer industry itself, the backroom big computers, wasn't big enough to keep IBM's growth rate going. And so he said, go to Silicon Valley and buy a half a dozen companies for me. Now, I understand IBM at that time was the biggest company in the world from the point of view of profits and value of the stock and so on. So, and he had the biggest engineering organization in the world, almost 400,000 people in the company. And it got to be more than that. So, anyway, his staff went back to him and said, Frank, you don't seem to understand. You cannot buy a company in Silicon Valley and expect the employees to stay more than one day. They will quit because they don't want white shirts, blue suits, black wingtip shoes, and they don't want sales organizations that sing songs in the morning and so on and so forth. This was the culture of IBM in the 60s. And so he said, okay, go find somebody within IBM and have them start us in something that is peripheral, not totally separated from, but peripheral to mainstream computing and computers. And so I had just done work at Stanford in the Grad School of Business, and I had this engineering background in Silicon Valley at the IBM facilities in San Jose. And so I was lucky enough to get the nod to do that. And so I did, and I got to pick what the peripheral business was going to be. And I looked at things like banking, I looked at airline reservations, so on and so forth. But growing up in Dayton, Ohio, in the shadow of National Cash Register, NCR owning 95% of the business at point of sale in retail stores and supermarkets and all kinds of stores for the last almost 100 years before that, right? Since the 1880s. It's a big old cash registers, remember, with all those keys and you push down on them. They're beautiful big machines made of iron, but they're very not very convertible to new technologies. And even though the PC hadn't come out yet for 10 more years, I could see that we could put a little box on the desk that would be like what a PC would become. That word didn't exist at the time. And also I had done work in scanning. That was my specialty. And I had scanned, microimages for the CIA. So for like you might have seen in use by, remember the guy Q who was in the James Bond movies, all of that. So I was interested. I mean, I had experience in scanning both big things to scan, like engineering drawings for General Motors, but little things on the head of a pin for the CIA. And so the laser had just come out, and I was aware of that because I had done some printing with it. So I could see that the technologies were there now to do a thing called item identification. And the Supermarket Institute had come up with item identification as a thing that they needed because they had terrible problems with reordering. They had terrible problems with price marking in the supermarket. They had problems of very slow operations of checkout lines. The customers were upset. And so they said, if you could put a label on each item that put a unique number on that item, and then we could look that number up in the back of the store and print it out on the check stand printer, then people could take home information about, what they bought at what price. Because before that, it was just a price. You got like 25 prices on 25 items, but you had no idea which one related to which. And so I could see that we could address that market. And so I told IBM, let's go for that. I gave them a proposal, just like they were venture capitalists. And they bought the proposal. And that was 1969. And in 1970, the Supermarket Institute, a year later, came out with a formal, well, they created a committee called their ad hoc committee. And they hired a consultant to tell them what they needed. And that was a very good consultant, McKinsey and Company. And so I worked with them to come up with a symbol. Now they, which later became the barcode. There were 14 companies. I mean, they asked all the companies in the world that were interested to do this, and
Sure.
14 companies responded. And in my book, I put a picture of the Business Week article where they described the selection of this thing. And fortunately, they picked ours. They picked our code. We had done an immense amount of research and analysis on the code over a period of 4 years before it was selected. And really detailed work. And in an appendix to the book for the technology-oriented people, I put a copy of the study that I did at that time in 1971. So it's a verbatim study at the back of the book, but you don't have to read that to read the book is written for lay people, for anybody who wants to read it, so you don't have to be an engineer to read the book, but you might have to be an engineer to read the appendix, but it does give all the gory details. And so ours was selected, and that was the turning point.
That is so amazing. We were talking before the interview how you grew up in Dayton. You went to an excellent high school and grammar school, and the high school run by the Marianists, and then college, Dayton University. It must have taken a lot of courage, though, to move from Dayton, Ohio, all the way out to California. So kudos to you, Paul, for that courage. Now, I'd love to hear more because I'm a big fan of organization dynamics, teams, and our listeners are as well. Share with us, please, about the formation of the barcode team, because as you said, you didn't do this all by yourself.
Right. So I did the proposal just with two other helpers. We proposed to IBM, we were going to do this. We asked for a certain amount of money. It was a small amount of money, 300,000 the first year, a million the second year, 3 million the third year. And then they said, okay, but can you go do it in North Carolina instead of California? Because we just bought 600 acres there and we were building a big factory, or they actually have finished it. And we don't have too much to put in there to manufacture yet. So fine. So I ended up moving to North Carolina.
Oh my
And
goodness.
of course, I was interested in what kind of engineers are available in IBM in North Carolina. And so North Carolina is a kind of a pleasant place to be, and quite a few engineers had recently moved there since they just opened this site up a couple of years before. This is 1969. They opened the site, I think, in 66, 65. And
Wow.
so several IBMers from upstate New York, which is a whole different climate, of course, had moved
Sure.
down there. And they had a pretty good staff of people. So I went down there and hiring and soliciting, not hiring people from outside the company, but hiring people from other projects and bringing them onto this project. And so I picked six engineers. They had varying backgrounds. Some were, in their 30s and 40s, but some were in their 50s or, close to that, and a lot of experience. And so I got experienced guys. I got people that knew coding and encoding, because one of the things that IBM was the communications center. It was set up to be the communication center of the world. So the codes that you use to send signals down a telephone line or down a wire, those codes are very similar to what you might need to put on if you're going to read bars or some other kind of symbol. It's just a data stream of electronic ups and downs, if you like. And so those kind of people were very good at that. And so I picked those people. I picked communications people, and then several other talents as well. And I was very fortunate to be able to find a guy who had worked on a failed project to do a point of sale device earlier, And he had a lot of really good new ideas that he wasn't able to convince his previous management to implement, but I thought they were outstanding. And he was from Rochester, Minnesota, so I did hire him, and he moved down there. All this is written up in the book. It tells the stories about how I got these different folks. And so that was the background of how we put the team together. It was about six guys for the first maybe 6, 8 months, something like that, the first part of a year. And then we started adding more people. After about 3 years, it got up to a couple of hundred people. But it took us, this wasn't an invent something in the moment, you know. And by the way, there were no patents ever on this thing, because the Supermarket Institute said, you know, if you want to submit a possible code to be used around the world everywhere, you have to put it into public domain. We're not going to make anybody the biggest, richest person in the world.
Oh, that's
So we put
something.
everything in the public domain, so that nobody got rich off off of any royalties, or no royalties have ever been paid on the thing. Of course, the companies that build the hardware and the software that go in the store, they sell that, of course, and they make a profit on it. But nobody gets anything for the code itself. But
That's pretty
anyway,
interesting
that
something.
was what we did, and you know, it worked out very well. But I wanted to say that it wasn't just coming up with the code. There was almost more work associated with building a system around the code than there was with the code itself. The system had to, you know, check out people. If you imagine in the big stores in Europe at that time, when we were going worldwide, they had 40 check stands. It was like gigantic Costcos. They were called cash and carry markets. And they had 40 check stands with scanners at the front. So you'd have 40 people pulling items across the check stand all at the same time. You've got to read that and go back to the computer and update the inventory and get the price number and the cost and all that kind of stuff, and bring it back to the check stand before any of the 40 people at the check stand can tell it's taking any time. So it required a system of communications, a whole different system of magnetics for the storage at the box back in the back of the room. It required duplication of the system, so in case anything failed, it would cover itself up, because you have no prices on the merchandise anymore. So the price has got to be, the store would have to shut down. So you can't shut the store down. So all of that, and it took us from 1969 until 1977. I worked full time on this project with the team. So that was, you know, 8.5, 9 years. And it didn't really take over in the country until, you know, the early 80s. So it was about 12, 15 years before it hit volume, real volume.
Your perseverance is amazing. Now, looking back, Paul, were there certain things you did as the team leader which enhanced the probability of success? Because to do something like this, your leadership must have been incredible. Anything specifically you might have done that really enhanced the success of this great team?
Well, I think it's just all the standard things that everybody is, you know, everybody tries to do. You have to trust in your people. You have to pick the very best people that you can get, and you have to trust in them, and you can't micromanage them. And if you want innovation, you know, if there's six ways to do something, and you would pick way two, and you have a person working for you, and they would pick way five, you got to let them go with wave five and support that, and stick with it. And you have to keep everybody aware of what the ultimate goal is, not some little side issue that we're trying to do, but what really matters is this. And just keep singing the song of that, and be encouraging and positive, and all of those things. And people will respond. We were very fortunate to have so many people. And you know, like the barcode itself, I mean, there's a lot of misinformation around the world on who did what to where, because a fellow who was on my team later did invent and patent a code back in the 40s. And it was a circular code. It was a bullseye code. It was easy to scan, but not with good reliability. It had a tremendous number of errors. And if that had been picked, I think the whole thing would have failed. But the gentleman that did that called me up, after R Code came out and said, hey, R Code is so much better than that one. And he, by the way, coincidentally was working at IBM at a different lab up in New York, and he wanted to go to North Carolina. So he said, can I come down and work for you? Now, we had already done our barcode. Can I come down and work for you? And I'll convince the world that your barcode is better than everybody else's, because he did come down before it had been selected, and he was a big help in our getting the code selected. So we got him to join the team as well. But the
Wow.
world is confused that he invented the barcode that is the UPC code, which he had nothing to do with. But he did come up with the first code that was intended for supermarket. It's just that it didn't work. And part of the reason it wasn't implemented was that he didn't have the technologies 20 years before, such as lasers and everything else, to read it at all. So
Sure.
anyway, that's another reason why we wanted to get the book out, is to fix the stories.
Share the truth, no doubt about it. You've done a beautiful job of that. Now, I hope you don't mind me asking this question, Paul. Did even you, as team leader, have a feel for how the barcode would transform the world?
Well, we had fainting thoughts of it. I say we, myself and the staff that I talk to most often, that were closest to me. But when it was finally selected, which was in 1973, 50 years ago this year,
Wow.
then we realized, gee, wow, ours was selected. Now this is it's really going to go someplace, because this is an international organization, and we're set up. And if we can make it work reliably and with good cost effectiveness, it is we're going to see it everywhere. Now, we didn't think it was going to last 50 years. And by the way, I don't see it slowing down at all. It could last another long period of time, because just think of all the companies that are printing it, and all the companies that are reading it, and all the people that are used to it, and so on. And of course, we have improvements now. They've improved it to much higher density with the QR code, which allows the scanning in the other direction as well as one direction. So it's an aerial thing, so you can get a lot more data, many, many, many times more data. And so you can do other things. But on the other hand, it's not as easy and as simple and as fast and as quick to read and without orientation or anything. And so our barcode, I think, is going to keep going, where cost and efficiency and speed and familiarity all play a role. So I think it's going to go on for a long time to come.
Oh, that is great, great news, no doubt about that. Now, creating the barcode, as you say, it was a long period of time that the team needed to take. It must have been an absolute incredible learning experience, Paul. Were there one or two key learnings from this project, from this wonderful innovation that you'd like to share with the audience and me today?
It was that we predicted all of the technical issues as engineers can, but there were other issues. And let me tell you about a very interesting thing happened one time. The IBM board of directors, the biggest company in the world, come to the little lab. It was a big lab, but it's small in comparison to the IBM company in Raleigh, North Carolina. The board of directors of the company, so these
Wow.
are all the movers and shakers of all the companies in the world, and they all come down to North Carolina, and they're having a meeting, and it's chaired, of course, by the CEO, president of IBM at the time, whose name is Frank Carey. And I'm in the room, and they asked me to give a talk on the barcode, and so I
Wow.
gave a talk on the barcode to this board of directors. And somebody, a gentleman, asked a question in a very kind of tough, nasty tone of voice. He said, gee, as I look out into the world right now, there's a lot of concern about taking the price off the merchandise. I see labor unions are upset about it. I see, and we actually, our first store had been picketed because they were worried about the check stand operators losing their jobs. And
Oh.
then he said, there's all these concerns. There's concerns about the level of the light. Is it going to bother people's eyes? And so on and so forth. So he went through these questions, and he got about halfway through. And I'm figuring out, okay, this is he's saying, why? He started off, why didn't you foresee this, you
Oh,
know, I mean,
geez.
you've led us down a path here. And Frank Carey jumps up and he said, that question should be addressed to me, not to Paul. And he said, as a matter of fact, Paul came to my office and warned me about all these things some time ago, and I decided to take the risk. So, sir, you need to direct that question directly at me. And which part of it would you like me to answer first? And, you know, the guy sank down in his chair and then lower and lower, and he was never heard from again. So, I mean, but the thing that was so different was that all of the, not all, but many of the problems were societal problems. 18 companies passed laws against the code. That is to say, they said, if you take the price, if you have a scanner in your store, you're not allowed to take the price off all items in the store. And then they, you know, you people would bring in milk or something that needed to be chilled. And a guy from the government, Los Angeles, I know, followed him into Ralph's store and then cited the store for a violation of that law because the guy from the, you know, delivering the milk put the milk in the thing and it didn't have a stamp on it yet. The store guy hadn't gotten to it yet.
Oh.
And so that was one. 18 states. So I became a lobbyist. I was flying around the country meeting with state legislatures, discussing with them, you know, here's the thing. In Congress, somebody proposed a law. It didn't get further than just a proposal, thank God, but that they were putting a laser in the check stand. It was a half milliwatt, a half a thousandth of a watt. And he said, hey, they're using lasers to shoot down enemy airplanes. And so we can't be putting these in the supermarket.
Oh my
And of course, it's
goodness.
a whole different laser of a different class, et cetera, et cetera. But nevertheless, somebody proposed that law. And, you know, a lot of this came to bed in a little story I also tell in the book about our test store in 1974. One of them was in Montreal, Quebec. And I was up there, and a government official from Canada was visiting the store, worried about all these social problems that were being discussed. And and this was our first test store. It wasn't even in use in any stores yet, really. And so he started interviewing customers of the store. And one was a little old lady who was walking out of the store with her cane and her basket, pushing it with cane in one hand, the other hand on a basket. And this official from the Canadian government goes up to her and he says, ma'am, are you, might have asked a few questions, are you upset that the prices are not on the merchandise? And she, oh no, I love this. And she pulls out her check slip. And on the slip, you know, before it just said 59 cents, 13 cents, $1.50,
Right.
$1.40. She had no idea what any of those numbers applied to, what the product was. But now it said, you know, Wheaties, large size, 37 cents, et cetera, et cetera. And so
Sure.
she says, now what I do when I leave here, I go down the street to the next supermarket, the competitor, and I can carry my slip in and look at the prices and I can tell which one is higher because I can see explicitly what item it is that I'm pricing. Whereas I couldn't do any price comparison shopping before because I couldn't keep track of how much each item was. Well, you know, we never heard any further objections from the Canadian government at all. We did from the US government, but not from the Canadian government. So
Wow.
all those things kind of phased out, but we did not foresee that in the same level of impact that it had.
Sure, absolutely. Time is short, sorry to say, Paul. We've only got about 4 minutes, but I got a couple of important questions still to ask you. We have a lot of younger listeners naturally on Thank God for Monday. Might you have any advice for some younger professionals, college students, maybe who are involved studying technology innovation, especially as relates to how one brilliant idea like yours can transform the world?
Well, it certainly can. And you can't very well be in control of whether you're going to be in the right place at the right time to have one of these things happen for you. But what you need to do is just keep yourself very aware of what things can be solved, of what technologies do, of what kinds of technologies are around the world, and be aware of them and look at things in the big picture. What are you really trying to accomplish? And then recognize that so many of these things can be accomplished by a team that couldn't be accomplished individually. And don't burn your bridges. Make friends with everybody you run into. It helped me so often. I had to lean on so many people during the 8 years I was doing this work, and everyone I went to helped me. And it wasn't like before when somebody couldn't help me, I was rude to them or anything, because you may need to come back and go to them, because teamwork is so much. And that's why I put it on the second line of below the title page of the book. A team is the thing, and this was teamwork. And you need to solicit your friends and work with friends and spend your time with people that are effective and that you can trust, and trust them, and go at it that way.
That is so beautiful. And you've demonstrated once again the Franciscan saying, we have together, we are better. And you, as a team leader, clearly brought this team together to be on the same page. And look what happened. Innovation that 50 years later, still going strong. And I really believe from what you've said and what I've read, is going to continue transforming the world for decades to come. No doubt about that. Paul, we've saved the most important question for last. Where can our loyal listeners purchase Barcode? How can they best follow you, please?
You can get it on Barnes and Noble online. You can get it at Amazon. The barcode is the title, and it's pre-orderable until September the 19th, and then it'll be orderable. And a beautiful version in hardcover will be coming out right after that. It's also available from both of those suppliers in a Kindle form.
Wow. Listeners, no excuse. You can get it Kindle, you can get it soft cover, you can get it hardcover. Please, please, please. We've got a great Franciscan with us today. He could have held on to the good. No, he shared this beautiful memoir in this wonderful book of his. Now it's your turn. Buy one for yourself and share the good with a couple of others. This is really an incredible memoir. It really touches the heart. It touches the mind and mouth as well, but it's really very heartwarming to see how one person brought this team together and has transformed the world for 50 years. And as I said before, is going to do it for decades more. So please, please, please get out there and buy this book. Share the good, just like Paul did with us this morning. Paul B. McEnroe, we can't thank you enough for sharing your amazing memoir with us. Continued joy, success, happiness, contribution in this fascinating life now as a rancher. And thanks for getting up very, very early to be with us on Thank God for Monday today.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it immensely.
The pleasure's been all ours. Listeners, guess what? Once again, we're out of time. Greg saying our hope and prayer is that when you wake up on Monday morning, just like Paul does, you'll say, Thank God for Monday. Until next week's episode, have a great week, everyone. Bye-bye.